homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So I will say beforehand, for the sake of the recording as well, that I have cough. It's not that bad. I'm getting over it, but it's at that point where it sounds really bad, so I apologize. So today's talk, I'm calling Giving Shape to Our Lives, the Buddhist Practice of Vow. So just out of curiosity's sake, how many of you have made New Year's resolutions? I kind of got that sense that it's not many people that I know do it.
I used to, but I never kept them.
Well, and that's part of what today's...
Maybe for the first couple of weeks, but then...
That's part of what I'm talking about today, because I think maybe even if we don't make resolutions, you know, the new year, kind of reflect and think about where we're going and puts us in that frame of mind. So, as I go, I just wanted to first turn you toward Chosen Bae's book, The Vow-Powered Life, which I think is very, very interesting, because when we think about vow, we may think and, you know, have limited ideas about what it is, but in this book, she really has a way of helping to expand our ideas about what vow is. And there's many vows that are implicit in our lives already, choices that we've made, commitments that we've made that have shaped our life, that in a way we don't even think about anymore. They're just, you know, the background of our life. And there's small vows and short-term vows and intentions. But and there's all kinds of commitments that we make. But today I'm talking kind of specifically about explicit vows. So intentions that we set in order to become something or do something that probably wouldn't happen otherwise, if we just kind of, you know, lived by chance and let things happen and whatever, then it's unlikely that we would move in this particular direction or cultivate this particular thing or complete this particular thing. So vows give shape to our lives, and there's a strong practice of vow in Buddhism. I mean, we take the precepts, there's the bodhisattva vows, there's commitments that people can make to teachers or to ordination, and then we have a regular practice in our sangha of making personal vows during term student program, which happens once a year, and it's a two or three month period where we get together in a small peer group and each of us sets our own vows, but we share them, so then we're kind of holding each other accountable in a way. So today's talk I'll be kind of in two parts. So first of all, why change or keeping intentions, vows, resolutions is so hard? And then two, I'm going to talk about five aspects of vow in Buddhist practice that make it powerful and effective. So personally, I've had a love-hate relationship with vow throughout my Buddhist practice. I was really fascinated by the whole idea when I first encountered it. You know, of course, it took the precepts, but in a way, I thought, yeah, like any shortcoming I have, I can just make a vow and fix it. And so I made vows to get up earlier, to be more compassionate in my speech, to stop getting, you know, irritable, you know, like, oh, and I really meant it, you know, at the beginning. Yeah, I'm going to. But this, you know, probably not surprised, this approach to vow rarely worked. One of my teachers, so Kyogen Carlson, he said, when you make an intention, like a vow, it's like a law of behavioral physics. It's like an equal and opposite force arises. You have an intention to do this, and like this opposite force arises. You know, and so sometimes I would make those vows. Like I remember, like one of my persistent bad habits that I would love to just have a little switch and be able to just, you know, turn off, but I just get irritated and fly into little mini rages about little setbacks throughout the day, you know, just dropping things or printers that don't work and red lights and, you know, just, because I'm, you know, I want to get stuff done and I that blocks my forward momentum. So, I mean, I even had, took a little, one of those little counters, and I was like, I'm going to carry this throughout the day. And every time I have one of those, I'm going to do that, and I'm going to say this little prayer, and I'm going to da da da. And like, I would just, it's really weird and uncanny that you could wake up with that intention and then just forget it. Just, it's like part of me is just like, what? What was that? And then the next day I'd be like, wait a second, I was going to do, I don't know. It would just like, so part of me would just blank it out. But sometimes it would actually make it even worse. Even worse. The very intention not to get irritated. And I would get much more irritated. So what is going on there? And this is a classic one, right? I wanted to set my alarm for an earlier time so I could get up and I could meditate or exercise or do something healthy and, you know, enrich my life and, you know, oh, set that alarm at night. And then the morning, some different self wakes up, you know, a different self who says, that's ridiculous. That, who do you think you are? This is so stupid. Like, and just, you know, turn it off again. So, you know, it's like a part of ourselves ends up fighting back. And I've always envied people. Some people seem to be able to make, just set vows and intentions and then they just do them. I find that amazing and envious. But on the other hand, if you think about it, I mean, was one of the joys of Sangha practice is that if when you really practice together with other people for a long period of time, and you watch people and you get to know people's shortcomings and strengths and you see them their growth and change and you realize everybody's got stuff. And so we may think, oh, that person's got it all together because they can do this or that, but everybody has their stuff. So in a way, that ability to just, you know, I'm going to make this decision, I'm going to do it, you know, then that can often come along with an ability to just override your own feelings and needs and deny them and just, you know, force your way through. So, you know, but I still think people who are able to do that kind of through sheer force of will thing are pretty rare. And I judge that given the existence of the like millions of self-help books and, you know, how to change and all these out there, all these programs and books. So most of us struggle. And we either, you know, keep on the struggle, but I think a lot of us out over time get to a point where we're like, oh, well, I guess I'll just accept myself the way I am. Doesn't look like, you know, change is really going to be possible, which is good. There's a certain kind of, you know, spiritual acceptance and peace that we can make, but there's coming along with that can also be a little bit of a resignation of a like, oh, well, you know, so much for greater wisdom or realization, peace or compassion or joy or wakefulness or patience or skillfulness. You know, I guess I'll just be the way I am, which is, you know, I mean, it's not bad, but sometimes when you, something awakens your aspirations, like, wow, I could really be like that, or I really would love to be able to respond in this way. You know, then there's a sense of poignancy when you think, like, I've just kind of given up trying to make that happen. So, you know, why is it so hard? I have shared this book in the past. Robert Wright's Why Buddhism is True. And he's an evolutionary psychologist. And in this book, he not only explores Buddhist teachings, but also kind of modern psychological research and theory. And I find it really, it backs up Buddhist teachings. So in Buddhist teachings, we say, you know, we have no inherently existing self. Our self nature isn't what we think. Our true self is no self. We're a flow of causes and conditions. But this is kind of like, I don't know, I find it really encouraging to kind of get my mind around, like, why are we like this? You know, why do we evolve like this? And why does Buddhism work? So in the sense that there's, we have a sense that there's an executive I who's in control of our behavior. We have a conscious, he calls it the conscious self. All right. You know, we think of like, what do we want to do? And, you know, evaluate our situation and what would be the best thing to do? And I'm going to make this decision. And then I'm going to oversee the implementation, you know, like my body, speech, and mind. I'm going to make this happen. Like we're, he calls it your, like your CEO. Like you have a sense that we have, we are that CEO. And we have that impression, even though it's very hit or miss as to whether our conscious self gets its way. But nonetheless, that's kind of the only thing we know, is just to keep on trying to make it happen. So one of the fascinating things I find about the theories, the things that Wright presents, is that it really proves that our conscious sense of self is far from being in charge the way we think it is. So one example of this, he provides a number of examples, but there's something called a split brain experiment. So sometimes people, usually because they have seizures, really bad seizures, the two hemispheres of their brain will have been surgically separated. So for the most part, they can function just fine, but there's certain quirks. So the right and left hemisphere has been surgically separated. So if you present something to them in their right visual field, it'll go to their left brain and, you know, miss the other brain, and vice versa. So therefore, you know, because the different hemispheres of the brain have different functions, you can kind of test, you know, what happens when we show them this and which hemisphere. So if you showed it to, in the subject's left visual field, image or a word, and it'll go to the right hemisphere, which I'm not an expert on all this stuff, but it controls our kind of physical movements. And it misses the left hemisphere, which is more of our conscious processing and language. So the image and word, the subject will not report any consciousness of having seen that image or word. It's gone into the right hemisphere of their brain, but they can't recall it or tell you that they saw it, or they're not really conscious of having seen it. So if you flash something like walk to the right hemisphere, they're not conscious of having seen it. But then they will walk. And there's no conscious process that said, like, now I'm going to walk, and this is... But if you ask them, you know, so why are you walking? They will come up with a story. They will readily explain why they're walking. So this guy's like, well, I'm going to go get a soda. Like the left hemisphere wasn't involved up to that point, but he's walking, and so he creates a completely rational reason for walking. So this is what I thought was the coolest thing. It's that the theory, and they, you know, they haven't proven it, and maybe there's no way to really prove it, but why did we evolve this? Why do we have this conscious sense of self that really isn't in charge, or isn't anywhere near as in charge as we think? And the theory is that it's for communication, that I'm going to explain to you why I'm doing this, and I'm actually going to explain to myself as well as to why I'm doing this. Because as he says, so Wright explains, remember the guy whose right hemisphere was told to walk and whose left hemisphere, when asked where he was going, said he was going to get a soda. His answer wasn't really true, but it does inspire a kind of confidence in him He seems like a guy who's in charge of himself, who doesn't go around doing things for no good reason. Compare him with a guy who offers a more truthful account. I don't really know why I got up or where I'm going. I just do stuff for reasons that make no sense to me. If those two guys were your neighbors in a hunter-gatherer village, which one would you want to go hunting with? Which one would you want to become friends with? During human evolution, the answers to such questions mattered. If you were thought unworthy of collaboration and friendship, your genes were in trouble. So for me, that was like the first time, because from the Buddhist point of view, it doesn't matter why we ended up the way we are. It doesn't matter if we understand that, or if we have reasons for it. It's just, there it is, and let's deal with it. But that was the first time I'm like, huh, okay. I mean, in a way, it makes a lot of sense to me, and it doesn't totally delegitimize our conscious narration, but it also helps me understand, like, you know, to not take it so seriously. This is just my mind trying to make sense of this unfolding. And sometimes it's based in reality, and sometimes it's a bit of a fabrication. All right. But it's not, our conscious sense of self is not a dictator of what's going on. It's just kind of a participant. So the way Wright puts it, the conscious mind, the conscious self, isn't special in the way we commonly assume it's special. It's not calling as many of the shots as we think it is. It's less like a president than like a speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, who presides over the votes and announces the outcome but doesn't control the votes. Of course, the Speaker of the House may do some behind-the-scenes nudging and so exert some influence over the votes. So his suggestion in this book is essentially Buddhism and meditation and mindfulness is a way to help that Speaker of the House be more influential, that we can actually learn to have more meaningful input into this whole process. And from the Buddhist point of view, you know, we're that unfolding of causes and conditions, many of which we're unconscious of, but we have critical points of input. Our choices matter, and you know, so we can't just decide in one fell swoop how things are going to go, but we can decide to change our input. So the Buddhist practice of vow and the things that I'm going to describe as being important aspects of the Buddhist practice of vow are not exclusive to Buddhism by any means, but typically our Buddhist vows include these, and I'll list off the five and go and explain them a little more. So my sense is that, and there could be six or there could be four, whatever, but this is my current list, and that the more aspects of these a particular vow has, the more easier it's going to be to keep, and the more transformational it's going to be. So one is about motivation. Is this about petty self-concern or self-improvement? Or does it kind of transcend self-interest? Is it a vow that we're taking on behalf of other beings to serve, to give, to, you know, there's something kind of above just self-interest in it. So Buddhist vows are about relieving suffering, cultivating wisdom and compassion, serving others. So a vow that transcends self-interest is going to be usually a little more inspirational, easier to keep, and it gives more shape to our lives than self-interested vows. Two is that they're taken publicly or with social support. So, you know, like we take our precepts in a ceremony, in our culture, we take marriage vows, and we know what marriage vows are, so we can kind of help one another keep our vows. So that kind of, social support. The third, we discern carefully before making vows. Are these the right vows? Is this the right time to make this vow? So there's, and this is what Chosen's book does a lot about talking about, you know, our relationship with vow and how do we want to shape our life. And I'll go more into that a little bit. The fourth is the most transformative vows are the ones that have evolved within a tradition. So we have personal vows we might make as well. But the kind of vows, like taking the precepts or the bodhisattva vows, are something that those will usually end up being much more life-shaping than, unless the occasional individual vow, a life vow, might shape it as much. And the fifth is commitment. So keeping, I call it keeping a vow around. So even when we break it, a really transformative vow is one that we still want it to shape our life. So let me go a little bit more through each of those. So the self-concern, here's my example of like, okay, say you want to lose some weight, which is a very typical New Year's resolution. You know, if this is about vanity or meeting other people's expectations, for most of us, that's just not going to be all that helpful. And part of it, I think, is that as long as it's just about us, like my experience with, you know, setting intentions, as long as it's just about us, well, there's a part of you that wants to lose weight. There's a part of you that wants to eat that cake. I mean, you're against yourself. There's no greater purpose. So it depends on, you know, which side wins out in any given situation. But it's when it's all just about ourselves, it's difficult because we have conflicting desires. Or even a vow to meditate every day. That might seem like a great vow, but when we find ourselves not really doing it. I mean, obviously, part of us doesn't want to do it. Part of it's like, you know, that's boring. I'd rather read the news or whatever. So then it's just that kind of, it's just our keeping it too much within just about us and who we are and we want to be a good Buddhist or something like that. But the good thing is that some of these vows, even something like losing weight or meditating, if we tie it to something greater, then sometimes it can have more power. For instance, sometimes we need to make a change to our lifestyle for health, serious health reasons. Like if we want to be with our loved ones and be healthy and able to serve, we're going to have to do this. Like that brings in a whole nother level of motivation for making changes. And maybe the, you know, daily meditation. Maybe the focus is really on, you know, noticing when we meditate about what a difference it makes in our life. So then it becomes something we realize maybe that we are much more loving and patient with our family members. And then it becomes, I'm meditating, you know, not just for my own sake, so people think I'm a good Buddhist, but I'm meditating out of love for my family members or so that I can do better at my work or whatever. Support of others. I don't know. I do want to lose weight. I've heard Weight Watchers is pretty great. Signing up for a program, being accountable, etc. I mean, this is the story of AA. This is the story of many different programs of intention and change that we really, most of us need other people. And well, we do have this ideal in our society that, like, we're going to have a strong sense of will. I'm just going to do this by myself. But I don't know. Well, I was encouraged so much one day when I was driving with Chosen, who's the author of this book and, you know, avid of Great Vow and Heart of Wisdom. And she said, yeah, I knew I needed to live in a Zen community because otherwise I would never sit. I was like, wow, like, so even there's somebody like that I think, wow, I mean, this is somebody who's so dedicated, but she says, I need the support of others. I need community in order to make it happen. So, and I know for myself, like, I do, no matter what the intention, I do not exercise unless I'm signed up for a class and they're expecting me. Then it's no problem. Why is that? Like, they don't really even care that much that I don't show up, but I've said I'm going to show up, so I got to go. It's 9 o'clock, got to go. But somehow, we're just social beings. So that extra, sometimes when we want to make changes, we got to think outside the box. We may not be able to do it through sheer force of will, but we need some help. And that careful discernment, like I said, Chosen goes into this, but, you know, really thinking about the ultimate purpose of our vow. Why are we making it? How do we want this to shape our lives? And thinking not just about where we want to go, but also where we're starting from. So it's very typical when we do form an intention for it to be too ambitious. You know, I only meditate once a week now. I'm going to meditate every day. Probably not. I mean, I don't know. You might, you know, if you're one of those strong-willed people, go for it. But my rule of thumb is choose a vow that requires some change, but sounds ridiculously easy. Like, okay, I meditate once a week. I'm going to meditate twice a week. I mean, that sounds kind of like, okay. But no, it's going to be challenging. Remember that equal and opposite force is going to come up. So any, you know, kind of incremental steps. I'm not going to get angry anymore. Okay, how about when I get angry, I take a couple breaths and reflect or something like that. So it sounds, you know, very small, but actually that's the road to change. So that's just one example. There's also the, you know, what is the best use of our life energy? So sometimes we'll be, either whether you're making a vow or you're just kind of holding an ideal of how you should be, sometimes that's just not the right ideal for you and who you are. It's an expectation or an ideal that you've adopted. So my example is, you know, I have an ideal of a spiritually mature, compassionate, generous person, and that I would, you know, walk through my day and everyone I encountered, I would just, you know, give you my full attention and I would listen and I would just let you know that, you know, I'm with you and I appreciate you. And, you know, then as I go through the day, every person that I encounter would just be left with this warm feeling of support. And, you know, I kind of imagine, you know, the Dalai Lama moving through his day and just inspiring everyone. And, you know, in reality, I am deeply motivated by love, but I mostly just want to do projects on your behalf. That's just who I want to write stuff for you. I want to organize your Zen Center. I want to do stuff. And I get kind of impatient with long conversations. And, you know, so for me, I'm not going to be one of those people. That's just not, my life energy is different. As my teacher pointed out once, like I was talking to her about the irritability, and she said, well, that's because you have a lot of energy and drive to get things done. And so that's a side effect. You want to go here and something gets in your way and there's some irritation. If you were just like, you know, whatever happens, that's cool. Like there's no irritation, right? Because you don't care that anything gets in your way. So, you know, a more useful intention for me is to remind myself, you know, that I am doing these projects for love. And if I neglect people face to face because I want to do this project for them out of love, that kind of, you know, that kind of just is sad. You know, I'd probably be one of those parents that was like, I sent you to college and I put a roof over your head and like, you know, what do you mean I don't love you? So, okay, you know, you need some balance. So that little reminder for me is a way that just reminds me to, you know, balance, right? I do want to interact with people face to face and have them know that I care. So, you know. And then I guess, you know, traditional vows. You know, we have these ones that we conceive for ourselves, things that we might want to do or how we might want to shape our lives. But then we inherit these vows, like precepts and bodhisattva vows and marriage vows and various things like that, that, like, frankly, when we take them, we have no idea what we're getting into. We might think we do, but we really don't. It's a path of discovery. These vows have been, they've evolved over the millennia as a way to shape our lives, and we kind of just get on board with them, and then we see and we discover. And so it's a very rich kind of lifelong practice of vow when we do these traditional things. So sometimes rather than making new, fresh vows, we can kind of reconnect with the vows that we've already taken, or some of these traditional vows. And then finally, this committing to a vow and keeping it around. So I want to share a story that some of you may have heard from. This is, I'm sure Dogen didn't make this up, but he relates this story in an essay called The Virtue of Home Leaving, which is getting ordained as a Buddhist monk. And he says, without having faith, a courtesan put on a nun's robe for a joke. She was perhaps at minor fault for this action, but with the power of wearing this robe, she encountered the Buddha Dharma in her next lifetime. A nun's robe means a kshaya. As a result of wearing a kshaya for a joke, she left the household, received the precepts, and became a nun called Utpalavarna at the time of Kashyapa Buddha. So then he goes on to, he quotes the nun, and she is talking with a bunch of lay women who she is trying to convince them to get ordained, to leave the home life and follow the Buddhist way. And they're saying, you know, that they're kind of interested, but they're young and beautiful, and it would be really hard for them to keep the precepts. And she tells them, it's all right to break the precepts. Just leave the household first. And they respond with horror, saying, well, if we break the precepts, then we might end up in hell. And she says, that's okay. It's still worth it. And she relates how, so she had, you know, tried on the kesa as a joke. She was reborn, she was a nun, and then she was a nun with like impeccable conduct and great realization, and she got arrogant about that. And then she broke a precept and fell into hell. But then she was reborn and was a nun in Shakyamuni Buddha's time and then became an arhat. So it's kind of like, you know, it's all just part of the path. So, you know, what is it within us that is drawn to a particular aspiration? And Chosen talks about this, and it's like, I mean, to some extent, this is about that discernment process as well. Sometimes we're just have an intention or an ideal that it's just an expectation that other people have or an idea that we have, but then sometimes there's this deep resonance. We just see something and we think, I want to do that. And it's like a vow awakens within us in a way. It's not that conscious self, you know, imposing a program. It arises within us. So this is what happened when Siddhartha, you know, went on his journey, and he saw the, you know, old age, disease, and death, and then he saw a monk. He's like, and that like planted a seed in his mind. And I found myself similarly fascinated by monastic practice. I was just a lay practitioner for 5 years, but then I just kept on going like, I think I want to do that. You know, it's like. And that level of inspiration arises within us. So you may have made a commitment to a particular profession or to raising children, dedicating your life to a vocation, You've made heart-based choices, which then have shaped your life. But the key to the transformational power is the commitment. Is because if you think about it, like there's little various things that we try and take on, and we do it for a while, and then we don't really like it anymore, and then we stop. And that's fine. I mean, we may learn things and enrich our lives, but it's the commitment that shapes, you know, because inevitably we're going to want to drift away from it. We're going to want to grow in a different direction. So Chosen actually calls this as a conduit for our life energy. So my example is, so I was married once shortly after college for about 3 years, and then I was like, I don't want to carry this guy around with me forever. Like, So I just changed my mind about my marriage vows. I just like, I don't think so. And then, you know, after monastic practice, and then I met my current husband, and then when I contemplated getting married again, I'm like, why should I trust myself? Why should I make these vows? And then, you know, before I just said, eh, I don't feel like it anymore. Like, why? I struggle with that a little bit. And then my current husband, he pointed out that you only make vows about things you could potentially fail to do. That's the only, like, that is the purpose of them, right? Like, you don't vow to follow the law of gravity. So built into the structure of the vow is that you may fail at this. I anticipate maybe I will risk failing at this, or sometimes I will. Or so I'm like, okay, I think I can do that. You know, I can do my best and try to shape my life in that way. So just to review kind of the aspects of vow that I feel are helpful, help us not only keep the vows, but for them to really give shape to our lives, is being motivated by an aspiration beyond mere self-concern. We can include the self, but enlisting the support of others in keeping our vows, discerning carefully before making a vow, taking advantage of the transformational power of traditional vows, and then staying committed to vow even when it becomes difficult to keep it, or even after we break it, to still return to it. So I'll leave it there. We have a little over 10 minutes for questions and comments. Yeah.
Making a vow like setting a goal, and don't we talk about not having goals, the goal is goallessness?
Yeah, but that's a goal. I mean, I would say, like, it's a goal of goallessness. It's like, even that, we're not necessarily there. Like, well, I don't want to let go, you know, of things. So even that is something that we aspire to. So, I mean, it's always that two-sided thing. I mean, we have to accept ourselves and our lives just the way they are, but then we still, like, we have choice, and we have choices to make, and how are we going to spend our life energy? So one of the things that they would do at Dharma Rain at the beginning of they called it a term, was to begin in January, was to just, like, everybody make a vow and then we'll share it. And I always felt a little bit like, I don't know, like I'm going to just make up a vow on the spot. Like, you know, that was like, I don't know. But I did want to throw that out there, seeing as we won't have a term student program in this spring, you know, that I don't know if anybody's interested in a way that we could form and share vows and help one another keep them. Anybody has any suggestions? Thought about like a bulletin board. Put up your vow for the next 3 months or something. I mean, would you feel a little bit more supported in your intention if you knew it was like up in the tea room? You know, there's Bruce. I'm going to...
There's something about the piece of paper as opposed to just pushing it.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so I guess, I don't know, maybe I'll invite vows. I'll send it out on the newsletter and find a way to kind of post them here. And just, it's good to make them time limited. I mean, there's certain vows that we might want to take on more as life vows, but that's usually after a period of discernment. So, you know, a limited period of time helps us stay true to them, because it's not like a daunting, like, I gotta do this forever. Yeah.
If we have such a bulletin board or a board to put things, could we put it in a more sacred space, such as this space, rather than the tea room? It would seem to give it more gravity and perhaps protection.
Maybe it could be over there in the corner. Because we already have our kind of wall of compassion behind Kanzeon. Well, I just don't want anybody to have to be staring at it when they're doing Kinhin.
Okay.
Read it, you know, it's a little distracting, like, Although they'd be reminded of your vow every time they went by.
One of the ideas is to have it visible, as opposed to fold it up.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking, like, maybe in a frame or something like that, to just... That'd be kind of sweet. And inspirational. I know my vow that I will make is to practice metta when I am feeling irritated and judgmental of people. And I always hesitate to say that because you might think I'm irritated and judgmental with you, but as I think I've said before, like, I don't have that problem when I'm here. It's kind of like you might feel with your own, like, loved ones, you know, like, you feel responsible, like, so when I'm here, I feel very, like, open and kind and whatever, but not so, you know, I don't know, especially when I, like, go to the grocery store or the gym or something, and I'm just like, oh, why do you have to, you know, put your water bottle on the bench? People need to sit down, you know, like, just, you know, it's just a constant complaint and just kind of a sense of a divisiveness from people, like we're kind of competing for space and just, you know, that kind of thing can go on at a subtle level just constantly. And it's like, you know, at some point that kind of, we call it the way-seeking mind arises, Bodhi mind of like, I don't really want to do that. Do I want to really, like, you know, is this how it, because, you know, someday, if we get dementia, this is all that's going to be there. This is going to be the loop that we've worn that's going to be just like, rah, 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 rah. So do we want to, you know, keep reinforcing that, or we want to do something different? So I'm like, okay, I'm ready to try to actually shift that. So when I, instead of that irritated, like, all right, so it's, I, in a way, and this is what's useful too about putting it into words. You know, like, how would I phrase that? So in a way, I'd say, like, I want to soften my heart toward all beings. So for me, that's... So I encourage you to think about that, about, like, what you might want to do for the next 3 months or so, and I'll send out a reminder in the newsletter, and send me the text. And any other... Yeah.
I just want to thank you for that today. That was super helpful. And I always hesitate, like, with my resolutions at the beginning of the year to tell people, because then I really have to go through them. It's kind of setting myself up. Yeah, like, no one will know but me. So it picks up way to frame it that's larger than yourself, like how, what's my intention for these changes is really, on one level it is myself, but on another level it is everyone around me, mm-hmm. who will benefit from improved ability to be there and present and loving you. So it's good to keep that in mind.
Yeah, and Chosen talks about it as like means versus vows, and that sometimes you might say, you know, like I vow to eat more green vegetables or something like that, but then a way that's a, like what's in, why are you doing that? What's underneath it? And maybe it's like I want to honor and take care of my body, you know, which is a gift, and do that by. You know, then you might have these specifics. So it kind of ties it to something that's more inspirational. And I don't know, it also helps to, like, so you don't forget. This is a pretty common thing with the term student. Like, we, you know, be like, yeah, we would check in at the end of the 3 months and like, I can't remember, what was my second vow? So that's another reason why, like, those traditional vows, like, we regularly, you know, we study the precepts every year. We recite the precepts frequently on Tuesdays. We recite the Bodhisattva vow. Like, we revisit those really regularly in order to keep them alive and fresh. All right, well, thank you all. Oh!
Oh, thank you.
I have a formal. Formal ending to Dharma talk I keep forgetting to do. Yes, yes. I might bow. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita.